Hey folks, this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. You may know that May is Mental Health Awareness Month, a good reminder that whatever you're going through, you don't have to go through it alone. You know, from time to time, I've struggled with anxiety and insomnia, and when that happens, having someone to talk to get unbiased support really helps. Use this opportunity to check in with yourself. If you've been feeling overwhelmed, stuck, anxious, or unsure, I hope you know these feelings are more common than you think, and you don't have to navigate them alone. With over 30,000 therapists who are fully licensed in the U.S., BetterHelp is one of the world's largest online therapy platforms, having served over 6 million people globally. And it works. With an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. BetterHelp does the initial matching for you, so you can focus on your therapy goals. And with 12-plus years of experience and an industry-leading match fulfillment rate, they typically get it right the first time. If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time. You don't have to be on this journey alone. Find support and have someone with you in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am thrilled to be here with another Master Clinician episode with an incredible clinician and person and a true Master Clinician, Dr. Phil Adams. I want to read, as I tend to try to do, some of the nomination letters that came in for Dr. Adams before I welcome him officially to the show. Dr. Adams is really someone who stood out amongst both his peers and his trainees. They wrote some of the following comments. Dr. Adams, for the past 3.5 years, I've had the pleasure of working alongside Dr. Adams in the classroom, in the operating room, at conferences, and most recently this year, very closely as a chief resident. All I can think of is I wish everyone else had the privilege of working with him and learning from him. He's a pediatric cardiac anesthesiologist, a master physiologist, and a wizard in the operating room, and yet he maintains a level of humility that is inspiring and comforting to all of us. Another wrote, I had the pleasure of working with him multiple times in the operating room, and no matter what the situation, complexity, or course, he always kept his cool, stuck to his principles, did right by the patient, and most impressively, always taught me something. He's always teaching, always laughing, and always putting others first. When I think of Dr. Adams, I think that's who I want to be. Someone who everyone loves, respects, and the first person they go to when something goes wrong, but also the first person they'd want to have a beer with after everything goes right. I'd be remiss if I did not mention just how great of a person he is outside of the OR. Despite being an active researcher, loving, caring father and husband, and pediatric cardiac anesthesiologist, he still found so much time to show up for his residents, whether it be a social event, orientation, presentations, lectures, graduations, or town halls. He was always there to show his face, have our backs, and be supportive. His passion for resident well-being, education, and clinical experience is second to none. He is truly a role model for me and many of my classmates, a truly special man, and certainly a master clinician. Another wrote, Dr. Adams has a special place in my heart in particular and is the inspiration for my fellowship choices, both peds and peds cardiac. Despite being a program director, father, and researcher, he makes himself exceptionally available to us with his whole heart. If I can one day become half the anesthesiologist he is, I will have accomplished more than I could have ever dreamed. I often find myself thinking, imagine how good I would be if I could work with Phil every day, because just being around him results in an infectious drive to do my absolute best. And one of his colleagues wrote, I have had the privilege of working alongside him for 10 years, and he is the kind of attending who elevates everyone around him, residents, fellows, and peers alike, and does so with a steadiness and generosity that is genuinely rare. So Dr. Phil Adams is an associate professor of anesthesiology and perioperative medicine at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, and he's an attending pediatric cardiac and transplant anesthesiologist at UPMC Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. He served as the anesthesiology residency program director for UPMC Anesthesiology until just recently, and he also serves on the leadership council of UPMC Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh and is the chair of the Professional Practice Evaluation Committee. He's also the editor-in-chief or co-editor-in-chief of the Journal of Education in Perioperative Medicine. He's a fantastic person who I've known for a while, and Phil, such a pleasure. Welcome to the show.
Wow, that's incredible. I swear I didn't pay any of those people. This was... It's so awesome and such an honor and privilege to be on the ACRAC podcast. This is so cool.
Well, it is really a pleasure to have you. So, you know, this is a really fun opportunity for us to get to chat about some of those things that have made those people write the things they write. So, you know, we'll cover a lot of really great ground as to what makes you the person and clinician that you are. Let's start with some clinical stuff. As I mentioned, you do pediatric cardiac and transplant anesthesiology. So talk to me a little bit about that. What are some of the things? First of all, that's a very intense field. Tell me a little bit about how you got it. How did you decide to choose those fields? And then, you know, what are some of the key things you've learned over the years in doing that work that you would want to pass on to other people?
Yeah, sure. A lot of it is the combination of passion and probably a little sprinkle of opportunity as well. My pathway wasn't the most straightforward coming out of residency. I got into research and I was doing this research fellowship. And because you dedicate so much time to research, the clinical time was only at 20%, which A, you don't make a ton of money, and B, it's hard to, I really wanted to keep up with my clinical skills. And that's when I was first approached to being on the transplant team. And by transplant, well, at least how we refer to it, that's basically diaphragm down. Our cardiac team handles obviously all the cardiac, but then heart and lung, diaphragm up kind of transplant. So that's what transplant refers to: liver, kidney, small bowel. It was in that period when they're like, "Hey, you like big cases? Do you want to be on this transplant team?" And I'm like, "Sure, I get a little extra money, and then I get to it didn't quite." Because it was all call, it didn't interfere with the research stuff. And, of course, it always happens on off hours too. So that's the opportunity component of it. But yeah, I loved peds cardiac. I thought in medical school, I always wanted to go into anesthesiology. That's what I went into, and then kind of rolled in, rolled out as I went through, and then really never wavered. But I distinctly remember being in the cardiology block. It's still in the didactic years and learning. I mean, I don't know how many days or lectures it was on congenital heart disease. I'm like, wow, this is the coolest stuff in the world. Too bad I'm going to be an anesthesiologist and I'll never like take care of these people. It was like such a duh, you dummy. Like they have to have surgery too. And, as I started training and, got to meet other people and learn more about the field, it was definitely the one that I knew I was going to just have a beeline straight toward.
Awesome. Well, obviously it was a good choice. So as you've practiced these two specialties, pediatric cardiac, and I assume pediatric transplant, or do you do adult transplant too?
Peds only. Yep.
Yeah. So as you've done these two fields now, what are some of the things you've picked up over time that have worked well for you that you teach your trainees about how to be successful in these areas?
Yeah. Oh gosh. There's the big lessons, like the big time things that stick with you forever. And then, there's the daily lessons or the case by case lessons. Feedback is one of those tough things. We all talk about feedback, right? And I find best, like as soon as we're done with the case, we're kind of turning over. I know maybe a little distracting, probably not the best, but it's like, wow, remember this? Like, how did that, this could have gone differently. Should we have chose that? I'm always thinking of things like that. And then of course, the kind of the big time events, the ones that, we never really want to go through, but, inevitably, and, with high acuity patients, high stakes, we experience those, they really tend to stick around. I would say, some of the things that stand out is we've all done it. We've been in that roller coaster, right? Where, let's talk blood pressure. Blood pressure is scraping the floor and it's terrifying. We see that and that number's blinking on the screen and you want to fix it, with the surgeon to see it. We know it's bad for the patient. And there's that urge to, want to change five things at once, right? Fix every, push this button, turn that knob, give this med. And then the next thing you know, the pressure's sky high. And now you're like, oh geez, this is equally, just as bad. We're bleeding. Oh God, what did I do now? And it's hard to get off of that because you see these horrible blinking numbers and you want them to go away and you want them to go away now. But that's a lot of anesthesiology, right? A lot of us go into it. We love that instant gratification. We love making those numbers be what we want them to be. And, on your average patient, we do a really good job of that. I'd say in sick patients, we do a really good job of that, but super sick, critically ill, high acuity cases, really bizarre physiology. You only have a couple seconds to get it fixed before some really bad things happen. And so I tell my trainees all the time, the people in the room with me, one of the hardest things to do as an anesthesiologist is nothing, is to stand there for 5 seconds and don't touch anything. Just wait a second, you know, and you know, that blinking number looks horrible. Maybe it's something they're doing on the surgical field. Like, let's look, what are they doing? Is this going to go away in 10 seconds because they're going to, you know, let go of whatever they're squeezing, turning to the side? You know, what is the exact etiology? You know, let's not touch every knob and button. Let's start with one thing. And it's so difficult to do because, like I said, we see that horrible blinking number. We just want it to be gone. But yeah, I think, you know, that's one of those lessons. Stand back. Just don't do anything. And sometimes the surgeons even says, aren't you going to do something? I'm going to say, yeah, I'm going to wait 10 seconds and just give me one. Let me think. You know, I don't instantly know the etiology of every single bad thing. Let me think. Let me figure this one out. And we're going to go one step at a time.
Yeah, that rings so true. I remember very distinctly when I was a CA1 on call and I was in a craniotomy emergent case and the patient was just crashing, blood pressure was crashing, and our attending told me to push I think it was like a unit of vasopressin. I think we were pushing vasopressin, and we did, you know, I did, and it didn't, like, nothing happened immediately in like the first 1 second, and I was getting ready to push more, and she said, just wait. And I just remember feeling like this can't be the right move to wait. Like, you know, everything seems to be getting worse. And of course, after, you know, 20 seconds, it started to get better. But that willingness to trust the intervention and wait takes some real learning and confidence.
Oh, and it's only through having screwed up so many things along the way that I'm like, geez, if I could just pump the brakes a little bit. And yeah, we do an anesthesiology all the time, right? You know, create a differential. But sometimes we're in such a hurry that differential is like two things and, you miss a lot of what's actually happening. And, but yeah, take that time, think about things.
So one of the things I know we do, of course, in anesthesiology in general, but certainly when you are doing peds cardiac cases and transplant cases, it's a big team taking care of the patient. So what are some tips you would have for people about how to work successfully in those kind of teams?
Yeah, I think that's another big reason I like, you know, being in transplant cases, being in the cardiac room is, I think everyone in the room recognizes they can't do it alone. And I mean, that's pretty much true for everything, but we've all worked with people who, well, you know what I mean. But in these, you know, again, really sick patients, I think the surgeons have a real appreciation for what we do and how we keep these patients alive and safe and manage this physiology throughout. And, you know, and our trust in them as well, you know, making the right decisions and, you know, cutting the right things, sewing together the right things. And the communication too, that's a tough lesson. You know, we just talked about being on the roller coaster. But you know, it's like any good relationship, right? It comes down to communication. And there have been times where I, as the anesthesiologist, and feel such an obligation because it's my job is to manage this physiology throughout. And I would see, you know, again, the bad things, you know, a rhythm issue or a blood pressure issue, something would change. And my gut reaction, my instinct is like, I need to fix this. This is on me. And, let's go. Let's work through this. Let's figure it out. And I've come to realize that as I'm doing that, I also need to be communicating that with the surgeons. I know it sounds intuitive, but you know, on an average day-to-day case, we're probably not thinking that all the time. Every time you give a fluid bolus to a hypotensive patient after induction, you're really not communicating that because it just kind of goes hand in hand with induction. But what I found is, you know, when I wouldn't say things and I'm like struggling to fix them by myself, you know, once the surgeon looks up and realizes, hey, what's going on? And I say, yeah, I've been dealing with this. He's like, you know, I would have released the tension or I would have done this. And, you know, you got to tell me these things. And so, again, it's not a failure to say, hey, I've noticed some rhythm issues. I'm going to check a blood gas, make sure our electrolytes are good. That's not a failure. That is just keeping everybody all on the same page. Because again, it could be, I'm using that example because they were pulling the aorta, there was tension on the coronaries and we were having some issues. So all it took really was them easing the tension, and it wasn't anything I was going to fix with a blood gas or potassium. So that's again one of those kind of lesson learned things. But again, especially in the cardiac room, it goes beyond even surgeon and anesthesiologist. The scrub techs are magicians. I have no clue, like, how they know, they anticipate, they're holding in their hands. I mean, they are as much a surgeon as I feel the surgeons are sometimes. And the circulators as well, just being so on top of things. And perfusion, I mean, it takes everybody. And I really admire our senior surgeon. I've heard him say to his, you know, junior surgeon, to the trainees, and this is coming from a surgeon, he said, you know, let anesthesia do anesthesia, let perfusion do perfusion, and you operate. And, you know, that freedom is like, wow, like, that's, he's letting me do my job and not trusting me. And that's a big responsibility too. You know, then it really ups the stakes. Like, I need to be on my game. I need to be here for this patient. I need to be doing this the right way. And I need to be communicating everything I'm doing, so we're all on the same page. So
yeah,
I've always liked those team aspects.
Yeah. That also rings true. I feel like I communicate things to the surgeons so much more than I did when I was younger. You know, I think something about, maybe it's about gaining confidence in yourself and your own practice. Maybe it's about developing the relationships with the surgeons over time if you're at the same place. But I do think that there's probably something about when you're a new attending and you maybe you worry that if you say, like, okay, we've got some hypotension, I'm addressing it, that they're going to think you did something wrong or, you know, be critical of you somehow, which I think is probably not accurate, but I think people are afraid of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I think starting out, you're so eager to be right all the time and to be in control all the time. It takes a little bit of that experience to realize that, you know, sometimes things are out of your control. And like I said, sometimes things can be fixed by what they're doing. And I, you know, initially took it as a failure, like, oh gosh, I have to admit that I've somehow let this patient become hypotensive, but it isn't that, right? It's in no way that it's really, you know, you've noticed something, you're working on it and you're working with them to fix it.
Yeah. And of course you find, I'm sure I found that if you start doing it, the surgeons do it back. And so then you'll have them telling you things they might not have told you otherwise.
Oh, isn't it so true? It's that, you know, like the psychological safety, right? I mean, I think we go into this thinking the surgeons are just these, like, you know, often angry and just, I'm going to have it my way kind of people. But we know that's not true. And I love the relationships I have with, I can honestly say, all of our surgeons. We're very lucky where I work. You know, I think they get a little scared too, right? There's the times they get in a bind and we help to bail them out. And so I totally agree. It's such a feedback. Right? The more I am communicating, you know, to a degree, like I said, they don't want to know every little thing that's going to bother them. They need to focus too. But you're absolutely right. I find that, you know, then they're more open to say, hey, I'm about to do this, heads up, you know, those kinds of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, sometimes you will say to people to channel their inner five-year-old. Tell me about that. What does that mean? Why do you tell people to do that?
Yeah. And I would say don't do it in an annoying way. But, you know, you sit with the kid and you're, you know, could just be looking out the window and they'll say, I don't know, you know, what's that person pushing? Oh, that's a lawnmower. What's it do? It cuts the grass. Why do they cut the grass? Well, because the grass grows long. Why does the grass grow long? Well, because it rains and then it grows. And then, well, what happens when it gets long? The yard looks bad. And so you want to cut. And, you know, it could go on and on. And I, you know, I always just tell people, have that genuine curiosity about everything that we're doing. You know, I always say that as an anesthesiologist, yes, we're there to give anesthesia, to make people asleep, you know, anesthetized, and to manage physiology. So to be comfortable, to be safe, and get through these things. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't know what's going on. It doesn't mean we shouldn't understand the operation or, you know, the why. Like, why are we doing this operation? What's the outcome going to be? What are we hoping to achieve? And so I think that, you know, having that inquisitiveness to not just be in there and go through motions, that's a little cliche because I don't think we really go through motions. I know the people are in there. They genuinely care. We want to do a good job. But I mean, let's be honest. The anesthetic is pretty similar for the majority of our patients, and it can get easy to kind of get in that lull. I think if you always have that, a bit of that curiosity, you can find some little nuance in every patient that even though they're having the same operation that you've done 100 times, maybe there's something just a little different with them. And maybe their outcome's going to be just a little bit different, or maybe they're going to react just a little bit differently. And so, you know, ask yourself, you know, why are they on this medication? We do this. We've done a colectomy. I've done 100 colectomies and none of them are on. Why is this patient taking this medicine? What does it mean? Is it going to act different? You know, I probably do bother our surgeons a little bit, but I'm, hey, do you have a second? I'm just curious. What if you did this instead? I see that you're sewing this to that, you know, how does that come to be? We had this amazing neurosurgeon, unfortunately isn't with us anymore, but, she was fantastic. She would always pull me to the side, pull up MRIs, and you find you learn so much. And then when you're not just going through an operation blindly, you know, giving our cocktail of medications that we give and making blood pressure go up and down, but when you're really like in the operation, when you're really in it with the surgeon and understanding it, I think that gives me a lot of professional fulfillment, because if you get into that lull, I think it contributes to burnout whenever you just view yourself as patient in, patient out, patient asleep, patient awake, meds in, urine out, and then off I go. That's an easy way to kind of get a little jaded in the profession. But if you just keep, some of it has to be outward, outwardly asking why, but you can do a lot of this on your own. You know, we were reading about a patient the night before, and again, you notice just a little tweak, something's weird, don't just, pass it by, always keep that little why in the back of your mind. It makes things way more fun.
Yeah. I love that. That's such great advice. Let's talk about some of the technical skills. So when you are teaching airway skills, what do you tell residents to keep in mind?
Yeah, gosh, I really wish who had taught me. I had so many great teachers. And I remember at one point getting like a metaphorical hand slap, obviously not a physical hand slap, but it kind of snapped me out of my sloppy way. And this attending said, do a laryngoscopy. Don't just stick the blade in, do a laryngoscopy. And I said, well, that's what I do every single intubation. I do a laryngoscopy. I take this metal thing, I jam it in the mouth, and a plastic tube tends to follow behind. Isn't that the laryngoscopy and intubation process? And the challenge was, and what I've come to realize is so important, they said, be a doctor. Be a doctor and do an actual medical procedure of laryngoscopy. And I was like, oh. So I say it this way. Okay. If you took 100 random non-medical people off the street and asked them, to identify arytenoids or ask them what arytenoids are, how many, random people off the street, maybe a handful, 5, 10, I think that you'd be lucky if it was that. If you took 100 people off the street and said, ask them to identify a tongue or what's a tongue. Everyone would know it, right? And so that's kind of like, well, let's start there. Start at the tongue. Put your blade on the tongue. And everyone's like, on the tongue? I was like, yeah, start on the tongue. And then sweep that tongue. Go a little deeper. What's next? Lingual tonsils. You have the tonsillar pillars. You can see the tonsil. Is the tonsil huge? Is it jutting into the airway? Is it making things more difficult? Let's go a little bit deeper now. Now the epiglottis is popping into view. What's going to be just deep the epiglottis, the vallecula? Do we have a Mack blade? Do we have a Miller blade? What's our next motion going to be? And so when you're working with your attending and your attending is saying, tell me what you see, I would say that, some people respond with Neanderthal noises, because what do? They bury the blade, they start to pull back, it's a tube of pink, and all you hear is like, and I'm like, I don't speak Neanderthal. It's a joke. I say it pleasantly, but what do they want to hear? They want to hear, okay, well, I'm at the base of the tongue. I can see lingual tonsils. I see the base of the tonsillar pillars. I'm going a little bit deeper. Now I can see the epiglottis. I'm going to go into the vallecula. I'm going to lift, not lean back. Okay. Now I've got, crisp cords, a wide open glottis. Like that is telling the attending what you see. When you just bury the blade and start fishing around and hoping you find the right, area to stick your tube, that is the response. It's like, I don't know. And so that's just one of those little things where they like snapped me out of my sloppiness by saying, do a medical procedure, do a laryngoscopy. And ever since then, I've never, ever done it any other way. It's always been the exact same way, just inching millimeter at a time. And even when you have a sick patient, you only have you know, you don't have it forever. Their FRC full of oxygen still isn't going to get you much time. I have all these blue babies all the time, but I'll tell you this, it's, you know, take going in, you know, no, not inch by inch, going millimeter by millimeter, which seems like painfully slow, but getting success on that first try to me is way better than going through it quickly, screwing it up, getting the esophagus. Now the stomach's full. Now your FRC is even worse. I mean, that's just a disaster. So it's saved me and it's helped me to teach better because now I can communicate better with the person doing the laryngoscopy because they're telling me what they see. And yeah, like I said, I've done it the same ever since. Never changed.
That, I love that. And, you know, I think I don't do kids, but I remember from residency when I was rotating on peds with babies, you know, what feels to an adult anesthesiologist like a tiny movement is their entire, you know, airway. So you almost, I can absolutely see how with kids doing that really slowly is going to maximize your success. And I actually think it's a great technique for adults too, to learn the anatomy, to take your time, know where you're going and probably avoid some trauma rather than just like jamming it in and then pulling back, right? To take your time and find where you're going as gently as possible.
Right. I say jam with love, you know, no one does it, but yeah, the idea that you just stick it. And I'm a little fearful with all the video laryngoscopy that we have that, you know, we lose a little bit of that because now it is literally just gently insert this device. And now you're glued to a screen and just fishing around for identifiable structures. And I still would argue that if you very methodically, meticulously introduce the blade and kind of have your eyes on the screen that, even with that, your success will go up more.
Yeah, fabulous. All right, let's talk about access. I feel like if you can put an IV in a baby, you can put an IV in anybody. So when you're thinking about IV access, what are some tips to help people get those difficult IVs, whether it be in a baby, which I think is the absolute hardest, or in any kid or even an adult? Hey, folks, I just want to take a second to shout out our rockstar returning sponsor, TrueLearn Smart Banks. I've used TrueLearn for my residents for years, and it is hands down the best smart bank out there. The questions are excellent, and the answers have clear explanations that break down why each choice is correct or incorrect. And now you can create flashcards, which are a key tool for high-quality studying and maximizing test performance. The education research is clear that spaced repetition with these kind of tools is the best way to learn and retain information. We use their ITE, basic, and advanced smart banks for our residents, each with 1,000-plus questions, realistic visuals and graphs, and even a calculator that mimics what you have on the exam. Our residents love it and get great results. TrueLearn even has a CME smart bank where you can get AMA, PRA, Category 1 credits after you finish training and an adult cardiac anesthesiology smart bank as well. Go to TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAG to get $25 off residency exams, USMLE, and Comlex smart bank subscriptions of 90 days or longer and up to 20% off other healthcare exam subscriptions. We rely on TrueLearn for our test prep, and I recommend you do the same. TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAG. All right, and now back to Dr. Adams.
Yeah, this is, you know, those comments were unbelievable and so heartwarming. But sometimes I wonder if people, they must think like I'm a lunatic with some of the things. But for me, it's so much like mental imagery. I'm always imagining like, what does this look like underneath the skin? What does this tube that I'm trying to fish this needle into look like? And, you know, whether I can, you know, see it, it's bald, you know, I put the tourniquet on and a vein's bulging out. Okay, that's one thing. But what if it's just like a faint shadow and like you said, like a tiny baby and I have a 24 gauge. So in my mind, you know, that, you know, the aperture of that needle, you know, that bevel, I tell everybody, think of it like a shovel. Okay. And think like you're going into the dirt, AKA the skin, the ground, and you're trying to get into this pipe. And with that shovel, you're just trying to lift that most superficial part of that pipe. And this is where they're like, what? And I'm like, oh, well, just think about it. Because you don't want to go through and through. You don't want to be out of the side. You're kind of lifting as you go. And that little bit of that lifting motion, once you get your flash, you know, hopefully then you're not already poking the back of that vessel. So you're just kind of scooping these tiny little nanometer scoops with that needle as you're just kind of trying to lift the top part of that blood vessel. And the second you do, you get that flash. Now lay down. You're already lifting up and it makes it so much more difficult with that lift again to go through the back of the vessel. So the whole time, like in my mind's eye, I'm envisioning, you pop through, you're lifting the top of that pipe, you're getting in that vessel, and then you're laying flat and just getting the enough of that angiocath in that you know you're going to be able to slide it off. And I'm saying this, and I get that look like you're insane. And it takes two or three tries, which, you know, again, in kids, we're lucky. If you have a, if you're in the tonsil room, you're going to get 10 cases, so you're going to get 10 tries. And really by the second or third, then I get like the aha moment. Like, I'm like, I get what you're saying. I see this now. That little lift makes all the difference to keep me from, you know, just barreling through and through in these tiny, tiny blood vessels.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks. I wanted to dive deeper into something that I think can truly make a difference for healthcare workers, FIGS scrubs. Made for us in humans, these are scrubs that have our needs in mind. They're durable, antimicrobial, and super comfortable, which matters when you're 10 hours into your shift. I love my FIGS, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves hers so much that it's all she wears to work. Ever since COVID, she's all FIGS all the time. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, a medical student, CRNA, or CRNA student, or an anesthesiologist like me. Investing in a couple of pairs of FIGS is totally worth it. We're partnering with FIGS to get you 15% off your first purchase when you use code FIGSRX at wearfigs.com. FIGS goes beyond scrubs, too. They've got shoes, underscrubs, and even jackets that will make the ever-present hospital AC seem like a thing of the past. And they come in a wide range of colors that will let your personality shine through. Try FIGS today by going to wearfigs.com and get 15% off your first order when you enter code FIGSRX at checkout. That's FIGSRX at checkout.
Hey folks, hunger strikes and you're exhausted. There's something healthy in your fridge or pantry that you should be making, but you just don't have it in you. Sound familiar? For me, eating healthy isn't a willpower problem, it's a setup problem. At least it was until I found Factor. Factor solves the setup problem with fully prepared meals designed by dietitians and crafted by chefs delivered right to your door. My wife and I want to give our kids healthy food that they will actually eat. We don't have time to cook from scratch. That's why we use Factor, and you should too. Inside your Factor box, you'll find lean proteins, colorful veggies, whole food ingredients, and healthy fats. It's always fresh, never frozen. My kids think Factor tastes like restaurant food, and honestly, they're right. Some of our favorites right now are the Southwest Chicken Bowl and the Thai Chicken Peanut Salad. With over 100 rotating weekly meals, there's always something new to look forward to. Try the newly launched ready-to-eat salads with vibrant ingredients like elote corn and miso edamame. I wouldn't have believed it until I tried it, and now I can't get enough. Get Factor if you want all the flavor and none of the fuss. Head to factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF and use code ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off and free daily greens per box with new subscription only while supplies last until September 27th, 2026. See website for more details.
Hey folks, lately I've been more intentional about what I wear day to day, leaning into pieces that feel easy, comfortable, and still put together. It just makes getting dressed simpler. Quince has been my go-to. The fabrics feel elevated, the fits are clean, and everything just works without needing to overthink it. Quince has all the wardrobe staples for spring. Think 100% European linen shorts and shirts from $34. Lightweight, breathable, and comfortable, but still look put together. And clean 100% Pima cotton tees with softness that has to be felt. Their pants also hit that same balance, relaxed and comfortable, but still polished enough to wear pretty much anywhere. Everything is priced 50 to 80% less than what you'd find at similar brands. Quince works directly with ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're getting premium materials without the markup. I absolutely love the zip-up fleece I got from Quince. I wear it all the time, and it might be the only thing my wife and daughters actually compliment me on. And it didn't cost anywhere near what I thought it would. Refresh your everyday with luxury you'll actually use. Head to quince.com/ACRAC for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/ACRAC for free shipping and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. quince.com/ACRAC. Hey folks, do you ever go out to eat and feel stressed or disappointed because you know you can't enjoy the foods you love without worrying how you'll feel afterwards? Well, with Fodzyme, you can enjoy your favorite foods without the pain. That discomfort you feel might be from something in those foods called FODMAPs. I know how frustrating it can feel to feel off after eating. I get it. I was there too. Then I found Fodzyme, a simple sprinkle over my food, and I experienced much less discomfort. And I got to eat my favorite foods again. For example, I've always loved garlic, but have really struggled with how it makes me feel afterwards. But Fodzyme really helps. Fodzyme is a tasteless powder you sprinkle right onto your food. It helps break down FODMAPs before they cause discomfort. Think of it like Lactaid, but for garlic, onions, wheat, beans, cheese, and other common foods with FODMAPs. And here's what really sets Fodzyme apart. Every customer gets free access to a product consultation with an actual registered dietitian who can help you build a plan that works for your life. We're so excited to partner with Fozyme and offer you 30% off your first order when you go to iCanEatAgain.com/ACRAC. That's iCanEatAgain.com/ACCRAC for 30% off your first order. Finally, you can enjoy your favorite foods without the pain. Just go to iCanEatAgain.com/ACRAC.
All right, and we're back. Yeah, I love that. I think of it as tenting it up as you go in, but I actually, that imagery, I really like. I may steal that of think about getting, just lifting the top of that pipe. I really like that. So how about when we think about physiology, tell me about Ohm's law and how you use that in your teaching.
Yeah, I obsess over that. It helps me just break things down in a pragmatic way. And I like math because, you know, math doesn't lie. And so it helps to eliminate variables, right? And anytime you can eliminate variables, things become more, more successful and more predictable. And so if I use the example of hypotension, for the attendings out there, for trainees about to become attendings, when you're working with someone and even like a good veteran, skilled, hands-on person, you usually don't get the phone call at the first instance of hypotension, right? You usually get the phone call when a patient's hypotensive. I've given 10 liters of fluid and I've gone through 18 sticks of phenylephrine. Nothing works, you know? So there's going to be some intervention, and those are always the kind of the knee-jerk reactions. And it's because oftentimes they are right. You know, our patients come to us with fluid deficits. They vasodilate from induction, or sepsis, you know, whatever it is. So those often are the corrections. But I hate only having two weapons in the bag. And of course, we all know that there's more than that. But I really rely on the thought of Ohm's law to expand that arsenal in a way. And so again, that it comes down to, it was created for electricity. Voltage equals current times resistance. But we can translate that into fluid dynamics, where it's pressure equals flow times resistance. And so, blood pressure is flow, blood flow or cardiac output, and, vascular resistance. And then you can keep breaking all those things down, right? So cardiac output is stroke volume and heart rate. So now you have, okay, so again, the outcome, the bad, ugly, blinking light on the screen is blood pressure. But now we have, we can think of it as a stroke volume problem, a heart rate problem, or a vascular resistance problem. And then we know that, stroke volume breaks down into preload, afterload, and contractility. So, okay, now I have, bad blood pressure. I don't like that. But now I'm thinking, okay, is this a preload problem, a contractility problem, an afterload problem, a heart rate problem, or a vascular resistance problem? And then you can start to say like, oh, okay, well, maybe this patient needs a higher heart rate. They have lower EF, or I'm trying to be general for the audience, but my mind is very PEDS mind. It might be that this heart rate's fine, but maybe this heart rate isn't fine for this patient, and they're going to need a bump. Then when you throw in congenital heart disease, we put so much emphasis on the systemic side of things, so the systemic cardiac output and the systemic vascular resistance. But with all the shunts and things that go with congenital heart disease, now it's pulmonary blood flow and pulmonary vascular resistance. And so basically now I have, all of the things, the preload, the afterload, the contractility from a right heart perspective, from a left heart perspective, from a pulmonary, from a systemic. And it just gives me such an arsenal to approach problems, to where, my solution for hypoxia might be systemic vascular resistance. And that's like mind blowing to the average person out there. But I know that I need to alter a shunt, alter a flow, change a resistance in order to augment a different flow, and then so on and so forth. So that's, I always come back on those things because I feel like, again, it's math, so it's not to say it's infallible, but if I'm convinced I have a euvolemic patient that's still hypotensive, then I'm not gonna go with more volume. And sometimes people think, oh, well, this, that, and the other thing, you know, the deficit and this. And I say, well, but we have good evidence, you know, our stroke volume variation, urine output, you know, all the different tools and tricks we have. You know, I'm a big fan of SVO, of getting, you know, venous oxygen saturation from an IJ as kind of a surrogate for cardiac output. You know, if that SVO2 is 85, then, and I think the patient's euvolemic, then we don't need more volume. We need more squeeze. We need vascular resistance. And, it takes that gross, ugly number that gives us palpitations and gives us a big arsenal to, come up with a plan and do it more true etiology, so to speak.
Yeah. I love that idea of breaking it down into component parts to try to identify the right place to intervene, which makes a ton of sense. You alluded to, you know, some of the differences, and really what I always think of as the reason pediatric cardiac anesthesiology is in some ways the most complex, I think, of all the different specialties in anesthesiology. You have a definite particular interest in single ventricle physiology, patients with Fontan circulation. It's obviously a very complex topic that you could talk about for a long time, but anything you would say, like, if you're dealing with that, you know, with these patients, keep this or that in mind?
Yeah, I'd say first and foremost, even though we consider them to, you know, all have the same, you know, plumbing, so to speak. So for anyone unfamiliar, when you have a single ventricle, we try to separate the systemic deoxygenated blood from the oxygenated blood getting pumped to the body. And so the surgical procedures are to connect the superior vena cava directly to the pulmonary arteries and then the inferior vena cava directly to the pulmonary arteries. And so all of that systemic blood really just passively drains through the pulmonary arteries and then gets back into the heart and pumped out to the body. I think the first takeaway is, even though they come with that sort of blueprint, so to speak, no two are alike. And so I think that's very important to put into your mind from the beginning. I think a good tip is keep people at baseline. Let's say a Fontan patient, even an adult, you know, let's say they tear an ACL, you know, they're in a, you know, work basketball league and they tear their ACL and they're coming in for an ACL repair. Okay. You know, you're not going to fix their lifelong cardiac disease or cyanosis with this ACL repair. So figure out with these patients what is baseline for them. Again, it's one of those trust things. It's sometimes hard. You know, patients will say this, you know, a lot of things to us, and it is up to us to, you know, take some of it with a grain of salt. Sometimes our patients aren't the best historians, but when you meet a, you know, 30-year-old adult who says, I'm Fontan and my baseline oxygen saturation is 88% to 92%. Don't feel like you have to achieve 99%, 100% all operation long. You're going to drive yourself nuts doing it. So know that that's a baseline. Know that with that baseline, their hemoglobin's probably going to be in the upper teens. And so, you know, again, if you get into trouble, maybe not an ACL repair, but, you know, a Fontan patient who lives with a hemoglobin of 18, they need that to keep their oxygen content up, right? Because if we dig into our content equation, it's, you know, saturation and, you know, our conversion factor in hemoglobin, basically it's saturation and hemoglobin. So living with the lower saturation, they develop this polycythemia. So if you're ever scratching your head, your patient doesn't look good and their hemoglobin is 13. To any patient walking in off the street, 13, you're going to be like, oh man, this is luxury. I got bonus hemoglobin to deal with. Maybe not in that patient, because they've, for the past, you know, 25 years of their life, have been relying on a much higher hemoglobin for oxygen delivery. So there's just a lot of the things that, you know, the policies or the protocols or the guidelines tell us that, you know, it really has to be individualized for that patient.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's really good advice. And I say this as someone who doesn't ever do it, but it sounds like good advice. But no, I mean, I think that little things like that, I mean, I love the idea of, that's such a great example of how we have to think about the individual patient, right? Because just like you said, 13, man, if I have a patient with a starting hemoglobin of 13, I am thrilled. But that isn't good in a patient who starts at 19, right? I mean, that's a really important distinction, and you may miss it if you're not thinking about it. And so making sure you are It's like I tell our residents, you know, you be careful. Don't fall in the trap of just cutting and pasting your pre-op right into every right. patient is the same pre-op, because you've got to think about this patient specifically or you're going to miss something like that.
Well, the other mantra of mine that I tell everybody is remember to always treat patients and not procedures. Because I think too, sometimes we even get pressured a little bit. You know, you might tell, again, say it's an ACL repair and you might say, well, I'm going to have 2 units of blood on hold. And they'll be like, we never do that. You're wasting resources. You're out of your mind. And you're like, yeah, for 90, probably more than 99% of patients. But, you know, for this one patient though, this is something they might need. I don't see how you could lose that much blood in maybe an ACL, but you get the point. You know, it's, the joke I make all the time is if you come in for a fingernail clipping with an INR of 10, I'm getting FFP in the room for your fingernail clipping. And so always, always, always treat the patient in front of you. We don't treat procedures. We don't treat appendectomies. We don't treat colectomies. We treat human beings who are having appendectomies and human beings who are having colectomies.
Yeah. And I wonder if you'd agree. I actually had this conversation with a resident today who was saying, you know, how do you deal with like a surgeon who you think the patient needs something and the surgeon's telling you to do something else? And I said, I think so much of this, that those challenging interactions can be prevented if you reach out beforehand, right? So I always reach out to surgeons the day before the surgery. And a lot of those discussions, and I think this is one of them, right? If you say in the operating room, hold on, you know, I need blood or I'm going to put in a central line for this fingernail clipping, right? I mean, they're going to be like, what are you talking about? But if you reach out the day before and you explain, this is my reasoning, this is why I think we need this, right? That's a much more reasonable time to do it. And surgeons are going to be much more open to your, you know, to thinking about your reasoning rather than trying to have the debate in the operating room.
Oh, it's priceless. It is. And again, it can be a little uncomfortable. Sometimes we're a little fearful, like, oh, I don't want them to think I'm stupid. I don't want them to think I'm a scaredy cat and I'm doing all these, you know, extra things. But, when I have said those preparatory things and we've had the back and forth, or sometimes I overestimate, I think, oh, this operation would be horrible. And, you know, a big tumor debulking. And then I come to find like, oh, it's a biopsy. It's literally going to be in forceps and out in 2 seconds. I'm like, oh, geez. Okay. You know, put the guard down a little. But yeah, you know, running the list with the surgeon in the morning, you know, we got these cases together. You know, that was very kind of you to say, you know, in Pete's cardiac, how tough it is. But again, one of the things I always say is, you know, my garbage man that comes and picks up my garbage, I don't understand that truck to save my life. I don't know what lever to pull. I probably couldn't even get it out of park. So I think whatever you do on a day to day, you get really good at. And so a lot of times my discomfort is in some of the non-cardiac cases really. And, but yeah, just to have that brief moment to say like, hey, I haven't done this in a very long time. My neurosurgeon, every day I go up and I say, mannitol, decadron, I know these are neurosurgery things. I'm not in the room with you. And you can just see there's like such an appreciation that like you're at least thinking about their, and they're like, oh yeah, yes to decadron, no to mannitol. And so, yeah.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely agree. Let's talk about the importance of empathy. I know this is something you try to impart to your trainees. What are some key lessons that you try to impart about the importance of empathy in our specialty?
I think it's one of those things, again, you can really get caught up in anesthesiology. And for any trainee out there, when you become an attending, life kind of changes abruptly, so to speak. You might get into a practice that's mostly hands-on and maybe won't change a ton. But if you're going to be in a team model, you know, a lot of times you get locked in your room and, sometimes you can feel like you're just sitting and know that you aren't. I mean, you're really taking care. You are taking care of somebody. People love that person. You're working in that team. You're working with that surgeon. They're relying on you. So know that you are never just sitting and, you know, I hear the word rot a lot. I'm just rotting in this room. Know that you aren't. You're no matter the case, you really are doing something, I'll say miraculous. I mean, there's not a lot of people that can just jump in off the street and do it. When you're an attending and you spend so much time running, and that's one of the big wake ups, the amount of running that you do. I can't wear clog shoes. I have to wear like tennis shoes because I would trip. I just, you know, you're in pre-op, you're in PACU, you're inducing, you're emerging, you're back to PACU. one of those 30,000 foot views is you see how stressed everybody is. And you see the anxiety, you see the, you know, you see it on everybody's face. And you know, you get to know people day to day, and you know that when someone's a little off, maybe they're bringing something home from home to work. And, you know, we have that ability, you know, we're really running the room, right? We're managing things. We kind of control the flow of the entire operating room throughout the day. And I think just really understanding your surgeon and, you know, like, where are they at? You know, what's their headspace today? Are they in a good mood? That's great. It doesn't just mean that, you know, you can hide behind the drape and they'll leave you alone. But, you know, they'll be more open to conversing with you and nicer to the circulators, or maybe the circulator is having a bad day. I think it really just comes down to understanding that, you know, yeah, I show up to work with my bad days or with my baggage from home. But like I said, that 30,000 foot view of just seeing all the interplay of how everybody else is, you know, a lot of times if we as the anesthesiologist can take a step back and just knowing that we run so much of this, to say like, hey, maybe this room needs a 10 minute break, or, you know, to the surgeon, like, I don't know, maybe talk to them about something non-medical related between cases. It's, you know, we have a little break room and, you know, try and like cut loose a little bit. I don't know. I guess just the bottom line is to know that like I remember being a trainee and thinking all these people around me were invincible. You know, the surgeon's never wrong. They're always directing things. The circulator knows these operations inside and out. I'm always screwing things up for them. I remember feeling that way, but know that there's like all these vulnerabilities too in these people. And we're in such a position that we can really alter the course of the day, you know, as we're working with people. And I think that, you know, you can be smart, you can make the right decisions all the time, but I think what stands out to people, and when you hear things like, oh, like everyone wants Dr. So-and-so in the room, I don't have the right answers all the time, but I'll work with people, and I'll relate with people, and, you know, be on the same level with anybody who's willing to be on the same level.
Yeah. And, you know, I love that you said for the trainees, right, who are all thinking, I'm never going to be as good as my attending, this person, that person, right?
We've all said it.
Right. I mean, you, right, you're here on this show as a master clinician, and we just heard you say you remember very much being a trainee thinking, I'm never going to be as good as these people, right? So, right. I mean, if that's such a great message for our trainees, is that, you know, none of the people you see as these master clinicians started off as master clinicians, right? They were once a trainee who knew nothing.
Oh, terrified and making wrong decisions all the time.
That's
such still will.
Absolutely. That's a great point, right? And even the master clinicians make mistakes all the time and ask for help and need help, right? So you're never perfect. How about, how can trainees be a good mentee? You know, I think we hear a lot about how to be a mentor as you get to be a more senior attending, but, you know, it's not all one way, right? So what's some advice you have for people who want to be a successful mentee in a relationship with a mentor?
Yeah. Again, I can remember filling out faculty evaluations and voting for, you know, best teacher of the year and writing these same exact things. Like, this is the person I want to be like, these are the things they do. And so that's kind of one point. So tuck that in the back of your head. And then the other point being, like you had just said, especially as an attending and even as a resident for to some degree, right? Maybe you're a CA3 and it's like, okay, well, you really need to help the CA1s. You're going to be on the senior on call, or you're going to help them set the, or you become an attending and it's like, okay, you're going to be a mentor. There's so much of this designation of mentor, and one, I don't think we do a really great job of teaching people to be mentors, but I think there's essentially nothing that ever says, how do you be a mentee? Like, how do you allow yourself to be pulled in a way? And I've always thought of it that way. I've always thought of myself kind of like a little puppet, like a little marionette kind of thing. And, you know, I would say this, you know, don't allow yourself to be pulled in the directions that you don't like or don't agree with, or by people that, you know, maybe you don't see as doing everything the right way. But for those people that you really emulate, that you see as successful or in positions that you want to be in, you know, let them make you uncomfortable. And I mean that from the standpoint of, you know, ask them, how did you get to where you are? Oh, why did X, Y, and Z? Oh, X, Y, and Z sounds a little difficult. I don't know that I'm ready for that. You're never going to be if you have that mentality. Like, you're always going to be waiting to be ready, and that time will never come. So when you go up to the person that you admire and say, how do I get to a position like that you're in? And they say, well, it's going to take this, this, and this. Say, great. I'm ready to jump in. How do we get there? So you got to allow yourself to be pulled. You got to be uncomfortable. And remember, uncomfortable doesn't mean mistreated or, you know, any of these kinds of things. Uncomfortable in the sense that things might be unfamiliar to you. You might be great at taking multiple choice tests, and you might be the best intubator and IV getter in your whole residency. But being uncomfortable is maybe getting into research or getting into QI or maybe getting involved in advocacy and reaching out to representatives. You know, whatever it is, it's not going to feel great at first because it can be new and foreign to you. But let those really successful people, you know, pull you in those directions. And then just remember that, you know, the greatest mentor, they can't do it for you. They can show you the way, they can knock down barriers, introduce you to people, networking, but at no point can somebody just like get you from A to B. They can just really kind of help with the pathway to get there. But if you commit, if you, you know, take the advice and put in the work, it's again, one of those cliche things, but you know, anybody can get anywhere they want with that sort of mentality.
Yeah, I love that. It's so important. I try to impart this to our trainees all the time is, you know, the best way to get good constructive feedback to help you grow is to ask for it. Go get it. You know, it would be wonderful if every attending just automatically gave all this wonderful constructive feedback every day. I would love that, but that's not the reality. But if you as a trainee specifically ask for it, you're much more likely to get it, right? So you want to take some ownership of your own growth and go get what you need. Go ask for what you need.
Yeah, and on that topic, I get it, but one of the most gut-wrenching things to me is at the end of the day, someone will come up and say, what's my feedback for the day? And I'm just, I don't know. Like, I just got done doing CPR in the other room, and you know, my kid's stuck at practices, no one there to pick him. You know, like my mind is blown at the end of the day, and it's such an open general question. But like, even for me as an attending now, we'll go up to a senior attending, and when I say like, hey, I see that you're on the board of directors of these, you know, societies. Like, what does it take? What does one have to do to get there? And where am I off? What am I missing? And I think even, you know, so that's me personally as an attending now in an academic career. But even as a trainee, if you going back to IVs, if you say, you know, I missed the IV twice, you got on that. What did you do? How did that is so much more directed, and I can work with that. I can walk you step by step. But when I get that, what's my feedback for the day? When you get that good job, I think that's because a vague question gets a vague response. But when you go in there and say, I wish I had made a better decision on the hypotension in our second case, then I can say, oh, okay, well, here's the things we could have done differently. Like that'd be my advice on that.
That's a great piece of advice. Let's talk about staying grounded. How do you stay grounded? How do you recommend that folks amidst the craziness that is life in medicine stay grounded?
Yeah, I feel weird even uttering the words like master clinician. It's so flattering, but it's the culmination of a lot of different life events, and I definitely wouldn't be the clinician I was without the other things I'd been involved in, like research and especially being a program director and having a lot of really difficult conversations with residents and finding so many common denominators, not so much in like the residents who are having difficulty with, you know, passing boards or ITEs, you know, that's usually easier to fix, right? Come up with a study plan, or someone who's having trouble with technical skills, let's do some coaching. But it's really a lot more of the personal or even sometimes professional kinds of things. And there's so many common denominators of, anxiety and, imposter syndrome, all these different things that we hear and people getting in their own ways and a lot of times making bad, you know, just kind of personal decisions, the things that people decide to do. And I find that so much of what got people to where they are, the way they grew up, upbringings, different things, people give up. up. And I get it. I get the residency is an extremely difficult time. I wish I could say that being an attending was that much easier. I mean, life never gets easier. It just changes. I mean, there's no such thing. Life gets harder. Everything is going to get harder. And I'll give credit to our current program director, Mike Best, because he plays this amazing video that, you know, nothing ever gets easier. Everything is only going to get harder, but you're going to learn better ways to deal with it and better time management and better, you know, communication skills. And so I find that people give up so much of what made them them, you know, things from their childhood, hobbies, or, even if it's not religion, but just mindfulness and just taking time out. If you're someone who used to jog all the time, but gave that up because residency is really tough and you're stuck in the OR, you got to find time. You got to find a way to commit, because being in that headspace and that, I don't think it happens anymore. Jed, maybe you remember this. Like, I remember old like desktop computers when they first came out. There was this thing you would do like every 3 or 6 months called defragment. It would like clear out the junk files and it would like reorganize. It was one of those like just computer maintenance things that with a clunky desktop, like 8 gig computer you had to do. So I would say, you know, don't give up your religion. If you grew up going to the church or the temple or the mosque, or if you if yoga was your routine or running, like when we give those up, that's where our brain goes to defragment and like break things down. And I know that without me committing to those things, there's no way I could be the kind of physician I am. There's 0% chance, because you gotta do that brain dump every now and then and keep your priorities straight and keep your focus. I'm a big outdoorsman. And so someone could be like, oh my gosh, how do you sit at a river for 3 hours and not catch a single fish and do nothing but stare at water? Well, that's avoided me like thousands of dollars of psychiatry bills, because I just, you know, you see beauty, you see nature, you get fresh air. I mean, it is everything. And so whatever it is for you personally, you know, stay committed to it. It will not just make you a better person. Well, of course it will. I mean, it'll make you a better doctor. I truly believe it. So.
Love that. Couldn't agree more. Fabulous. Phil, we've covered so much great stuff. Anything you want to add before we move on?
Again, this is an amazing honor. All these orientations that we do, you know, you meet your new residents every year and everyone does like a fun fact to get to know you. And this will now have been the second podcast I've been on. But my fun fact is that I've been on podcasts, but I've never in my life listened to a podcast. And that's no offense. But, when you reached out, I've listened to these other master clinician series. You're such a great conversationalist. And I've broken it. I've now listened to podcasts. I've listened to ACRAC, and I see why everyone loves it. And so this is so cool. And I'm so honored to be here.
Well, thanks, Phil. It's quite an honor that we were your first podcast. I will definitely keep that as a great, great honor. Let's move to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Do you have something you'd recommend the audience check out for fun?
For fun, yeah. I'll be honest, I don't read much. I'm really into sports, and so I'll put in a quick plug. Pittsburgh tonight, the NFL draft. Life's about to change for a lot of young men. It's the springtime, and maybe not quite a major sport. If you want to find something that's super competitive, super fun to watch, college softball. I get so excited for the College Softball World Series. It's so much fun and so competitive. I'm trying so hard to get my daughter into softball just because I've fallen in love with it. From a TV standpoint, I don't really watch a lot of TV either, but there is this series that's on Netflix. It's called Night Agent, I think, and it's had 2 seasons, and the third one has come out, but I haven't gotten to it yet. But the first two are incredible, so I think it's called Night Agent. But that'll be one that I know I'm gonna commit some time to try and catch up with.
Nice, awesome. Well, fabulous. Both suggestions. I am gonna recommend. I think I've shouted out The Pitt before. The first season of The Pitt, really enjoyed. And just my wife and I just finished the second season. And I will say, I think the second season, not quite as good as the first, but it's still pretty good. And even though there are definitely pieces of it that are very unrealistic in some of the things that residents, for example, do alone without an attending. But I think it's pretty impressive if you think about the amount of accuracy there is in things like just drug doses and the things that they get right is impressive. And of course, there's a lot of compelling storylines, which are fun. So if you haven't watched it, I would recommend checking out The Pit, seasons one for sure, and also season two.
You know, when people say like, hey, how accurate is The Pit? How accurate is The Pit? The thing I keep coming back to, if you remember from season one, I think it was early in the season, the episode where every time he tried to go pee, he just kept getting distracted and never actually got to, that's the one I bring up because I feel like there is every single time I walk into the bathroom and I'm just about to, I finally get to go, my phone rings like, we need you in Ortha. And I'm like, and you have to run out. So that's the one that resonates with me.
Totally. That is 100%. It reminds me of a study that I used to refer to years ago, but they looked at residents and how much water residents would drink on a call shift. And they found that, you know, they actually did like a motion monitoring, and they found that the residents would get up with the intention of going to get a drink of water all the time, and then they never made it to the water cooler. They'd get paged before, and they'd go back to the computer, they'd go to a room. And so they found the only way to get residents to actually get a chance to drink the water was to put the water in the charting room with the residents. And when they did that, then the amount of water actually went up.
Classic.
Well, Phil, this has been fabulous. Thank you so much for all that you do, and thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you. It's incredible. Really appreciate it.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrack.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at Acrack Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrack. That's patreon.com/accrack, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrack. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Taylor Duggan, William Mao, and Rachel Furman are our production assistants and social media managers. Thanks so much for all you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.